This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch! No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies and Prada she's a me, honey.
John Calliope, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curb?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is broke back now.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. If you can't already tell it, I mean, you got to know, Alan, that you're tuning into a pretty queer film show.
Indeed. And we're going to be talking about Beauty and the Beast. And Daniel, this is something you've been looking forward to for quite some time.
Oh, since 1991.
Since 1991. Were you even born back then, Daniel?
I was.
Just?
No, I was 3 years old back then.
Oh, still in nappies.
So tonight on Outtakes, we are celebrating the theatrical release of, you know, they're calling it this year's most anticipated film. I'm going to call it the decade's most anticipated film because I think it's up there. And you know what? The money doesn't lie. $700 million in just 2 weeks. I mean, that's big.
That's incredible. And the cash registers are still chinging. Chiming.
Sessions are sold out, yep. You know. And, you know, this film was made for $160 million. Now, that's a lot of money. It's the most expensive musical ever made.
Wow. That just stuns me to think what you could do with $160 million.
Well, think about what you could do with all the profits.
Well, definitely. And I think Emma Watson's got her finger in the lolly jar with the profits as well, which we might talk about later.
Look, it's such a lavish film. It's an exciting film. It's a bold film. And this is solid filmmaking, even for people who aren't enamored with the 1991 classic as much as we are. You know, there's no denying that this...
Are there such people that exist?
I don't...
Well, they're not listening to this program.
Yeah, you've tuned into the wrong program. But you know what? If you're not a Beauty and the Beast fan, our mission over the next hour will be to turn you into one. And our mission will also be to unpack just how queer this tale as old as time really is, because it is quite, you know, it's gay, it's very gay, but it's also queer.
It is queer. It's rich full of queer subtext, symbolism and allegory that sort of, and it is, goes back to this tale as old as time. It does really go back to ancient Greece.
Oh, like this story has been told in one form or another for centuries. And we'll be speaking with Professor Rebecca Ann de Rosario, who is a professor of fairy tale literature, later in the program to look at the literary origins of this tale. But before
that,
it's going to be a jam-packed show, apart from the fact that there's so much wonderful music to play, and we're going to squeeze in as much as we can, old and new. We will be queering this classic. So, you know, we'll be looking at Belle as the original gay diva. So we spoke with Eleanor Byrne, who wrote a text called Deconstructing Disney last year, and she made the case for Belle being the original gay diva, very Maria von Trapp-esque.
I'm interested to hear that again and see what she says.
We'll also be talking about Beauty and the Beast as a kind of coming-of-age narrative, and fairy tales like Beauty and the Beast is kind of acutely concerned with this kind of liminal space between childhood and adulthood as inherently queer.
Yeah.
And we'll also be, you know, in this story, domesticity, it kind of comes out of the closet quite literally, doesn't it? Singing and prancing in this kind of gay cabaret.
Yes, and Be My Guest.
This film really is about challenging heteronormativity, I think. It really is about playing and reveling in the queer, reveling in the gay. And I think that's why it resonates so much with gay audiences. And it does. There's no denying that.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think this has come out in the press recently.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Not only just with the fact that it does resonate with a gay audience, but also, too, this is the first openly gay moment in a Disney film.
Controversy. Yes. And to call it a gay moment is a little bit of a stretch because I mean, if you blink, you miss it.
I 100% agree with you, Daniel.
And
it's there. It's there. You might blink and you miss it, but it's there.
Well, there is something to be said as well about having LeFou be the kind of baton of gay representation.
We're going to have to talk about that later, Daniel, because I was not a fan of LeFou being the clown, the fool, representing the gay community in this sense, or representing what it is to be gay.
So we should actually say the film, the new live-action reimagining of Disney's Beauty and the Beast, it's directed by Bill Condon, which is already like a flag. You know, Bill Condon's filmography is profuse with gay stories, with queer stories. He is, of course, the director of Gods and Monsters, starring Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser. Mm-hmm. Kinsey with Liam Neeson.
That's right.
Mr. Holmes, more recently, with Ian McKellen.
Oh, yes.
And Dreamgirls.
Dreamgirls, yes.
And this is a gay filmography, right?
Yeah.
And this is the man helming Disney's live-action reimagining of Beauty and the Beast. So, look, it's not surprising to see this kind of gay appeal. What I did find surprising, even knowing the political climate that we're kind of immersed in at the moment, as I
in
do.
In Trump land. Is that what you mean?
The world over.
Oh, the world over.
I did find the reaction to this kind of one moment just kind of farcical almost.
It's ridiculous, especially with the Russians and
Malaysia. Well. Yes. And good on Disney for saying we will not kind of we're talking about a split second in this film, right?
Yeah.
Just a suggestion as well. So the split second is not even overt, but good on Disney for saying no, we won't edit it out.
Yeah. But I think there are a couple of other moments there that sort of you could easily read as gay, not queer, but actually gay.
Are you talking about with LeFou specifically?
With LeFou and also, you know, Tom, Dick and Stanley. Yes. You know, we've got the bimbettes, you know, the three women, but we've also got the male himbos in Tom, Dick and Stanley.
And there are certainly suggestions, certainly nothing overt. There are suggestions, but, you know, you blink and you miss it.
There is a drag moment in this film as well. That was in the original animated version, but I'm not sure if you remember, Dan, in the original animated version, when one of the characters is dressed in drag, he runs away in disgust. But in this one, one turns around to the camera and smiles. Yes. It is a transformation for him.
But you see, is it played up for comic value or is it legitimate representation? That's an important question.
I think it is legitimate representation because that moment comes back to us later on, not giving anything away.
Well, you know what? If you're listening, message in. If you've seen the film, let us know. Do you think it's legitimate representation? The number is 0427JOY949. You can email in at onair@joy.org.au. And you can also let us know whether you like the film, whether you like the original. And you know what?
Go for it, Daniel. Well,
you know, if you had this kind of magic spell cast over you and were going to be turned into a kind of household object, let us know. What household object would you be?
And why? Why yes. would you be that household object?
0427JOY949. Alan, kick us off.
kick us off?
What household object
would I be? Yeah. I will definitely, Daniel, I can tell you, it would not be anything at all to do with cleaning. That would just be not be fun at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I might go with the musical instrument theme that came out in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
So I thought I might like to be a flute. Okay. Because who doesn't like to play the flute?
Okay. Well, look, speaking of gay controversies... I thought, did you catch Ewan McGregor on Stephen Colbert? Because his response to this controversy
was
right on point.
It was gold.
Well, there was a little bit of controversy in this film. I think
there's lots of gay sex in it.
Well, that's just it.
There's
it's
a lot.
LeFou.
There's a lot of gay sex in this cartoon. And I think if you live anywhere near Alabama, you should not go and see this film. What would Jesus think?
I'll ask him.
Charlie.
I'll ask him. No, not at all. No, you should definitely say. There were rumors that there was LeFou had gay yearnings for Gaston or something. It turns out he dances with a guy in a dress in one of the scenes, right? That's the whole thing.
Well, no, I think he's a gay character.
He is?
Yeah.
I thought it turned out that there it doesn't actually say.
It's just like... He's a gay character. And it's 2017, for sake, you know.
Yeah. Is that any of your dialogue from the film? Or is that...
You're on Outtakes here on Joy, and we are queering up Beauty and the Beast, and that was Ewan McGregor on what
Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert.
That is the way, and actually Disney has kind of approached the controversy in that way too. Mm-hmm. It's taken a very hard line and said, no, we will not edit this one moment. You know, it's you blink and you miss it, but it's kind of taken that approach all the way along, which I think is fantastic and good on Disney.
Yeah, good on Disney.
We are queering Beauty and the Beast, the new live-action reimagining of the 1991 classic. This is Beauty and the Beast.
Hello.
You can talk.
Hello, Port. It's all he ever does.
How lovely to make your acquaintance.
Want to see me do a trick? What happens when the last petal falls?
The Nastel remains a beast forever.
We become antiques. What did you do to it?
Nothing.
Get out of here! Go!
You have to help me. You have to stand.
If she is the one who'll break the spell, you must finally learn to love. Tell us all
this time. Have you really read every one of these books?
Some of them are in Greek. True as it can be.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Joy.org.au for the world.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where tonight we are celebrating the theatrical release of, I think, this decade's most anticipated film, the live-action reimagining of Beauty and the Beast.
Dan, don't settle for decade. This century's most anticipated, you know. Let's go for 20 years rather than just 10.
And look, it doesn't disappoint. I mean, does it? It's a good film.
It is a fantastic film. And Daniel, I saw it at one of those, you know, gold class type cinemas.
Yes.
And it was jam packed. It's one of those mega ones. It was absolutely jam packed for a midday session. And there was just a real spread of audience in in the cinema, young, old, male, female, and it was a beautiful film.
Yeah, and there is something about the film that does appeal to so many different audiences, including LGBTIQ audiences. There is something inherently queer about this story. And, you know, that's something we've spoken about before on the program when we spoke with Eleanor Byrne, the academic who penned Deconstructing Disney, a really great text that kind of picks apart Disney stories. She did a wonderful job of queering Beauty and the Beast, and one of her claims was that Belle is a kind of gay diva.
You know, Daniel, I'm not sure if I see Belle as a gay diva. I really don't. I do see her as queer, and I think that comes out very clearly in the opening number, the opening 7 minute song, where Belle is described as being peculiar, odd, different from the rest of us, strange. It's a pity, it's a sin. She doesn't quite fit in.
Yes.
And I think that makes it very clear to us that that Belle is like us. You know,
She's different.
We feel that we don't, you know, from...
She doesn't quite fit in. And that's what I love about this film, because that was there in the 1991 classic, but it's really kind of hammed up in this remake.
Yeah.
It really is kind of emphasized that she is strange, and she's almost exiled to this world of otherness, where there are others like her who are different, they're whimsical, they're interesting, and they're set apart from the kind of heteronormative world of this provincial town.
That's right, but I think also too, Belle goes on to say that she wants so much more than this provincial life, which I think is something which many gay people identify with. We want to break away from suburbia and we want to move into something fabulous. And, and also too, Belle talks about she wants to find someone who understands. And I think that comes out when she goes to the Enchanted Castle. But I think this is something that we all identify with.
Oh, yeah.
So I do get that understanding why she is a... People relate to her, the gay community relates to her, but I don't see her as a gay diva.
Now, I saw this film with my 14-year-old sister.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she turned to me and said... You know, that's the Sound of Music. That one scene at the very beginning where she's kind of twirling atop the hill. Even my 14-year-old sister could kind of tell that there was an allusion here to the kind of a kind of reference made. And I really do think there is something to be said for this argument that Belle is a kind of archetypal gay diva, which was something that Eleanor Byrne said when we spoke with her. One of my favorite passages in Deconstructing Disney is your likening of Belle to Maria from The Sound of Music. The argument that she can be firmly established as a gay diva. I just thought that was so great.
Thank you. That whole film, I mean, Beauty and the Beast, is interesting because of this collision of two sort of opposing forms of the human and the animal. But I think, again, that gives us this opportunity for reading all texts that involve some kind of transformation, bodily transformation, give us an opportunity for reading the potential of sort of representing the non-heteronormative. Because as soon as there is a possibility of sort of loving beyond the boundary or the power of the kiss, we see a transformation of the sort of root, the narrative of desire or the narrative of policed desires. She's an interesting figure to compare with, say, Snow White, because, as we say in the book, she has to go and sort of make house, but in a slightly different way. She brings the physical crockery to life in this huge kind of haunted house. So I think that those animated teapots, I think they're inherently queer. They're just funny. They're camp. They are a kind of surrogate family. They're a banded together group. They're also brought to life after slumbering for 10 years. So I kind of like the idea of them being imbued with some kind of new way of being. They've been sort of dormant and then they sort of reanimated. I think is another nice way of sort of seeing them literally taken out of the closet. I mean, the cupboard doors are opened and out they come dancing. So I quite like that as a sort of figure for a kind of really nice queer moment, sort of a queer cabaret of teapots. Yes.
And of course, Lumiere is so kind of outrageous.
Yes. Again, I think interestingly, initially at least, we see either animals or in this case, animated objects taking on those roles. And so we see the campness or the performance of non-heteronormative is sort of given to other creatures or, in this case, animated objects. But household objects, I think, particularly interesting.
Be our guest, be our guest, put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre, why, we only live to serve. Try the gray stuff, it's delicious. Don't believe me? Ask the dishes. They can sing, they can dance. After all, miss, this is France, and a dinner here is never second best. Go on, unfold your menu, take a glance, and then you'll be our guest. We our guest, be our guest. Beef ragout, cheese souffle, pie and pudding on flambé. We'll prepare and serve with flair a culinary cabaret. You're alone and you're scared, but the banquet's all prepared. No one's gloomy or complaining while the flatware's entertaining. We tell jokes, I do tricks with my fellow candlesticks.
Put it all in perfect taste that you can bear.
Come on and lift your glass. You've won your own free pass to be our guest. If you're stressed, it's fine dining, we suggest. Be our guest, be our guest, be our guest.
It's a guest thing for guest's sake, so glad that I'll be blessed. Wise been poor and thank the Lord I've had the napkins freshly pressed. With dessert, she'll want tea, and my dear, that's fine with me. While the cups do their sauce-shoeing, I'll be bubbling, I'll be brewing. I'll get warm, I'll be hot. Sakes, is that a spot? Clean it up, we want the company impressed. We've got a lot to do. Is it one lump or two? For you, our guest.
She's our guest.
She's our guest.
She's our guest.
So we got thumbs over, over here, line up. Now,
it's your deal, it's your deal. It's your deal, it's your deal. While the candlelight's still glowing, let us help you live in love.
You'll prop your feet up, but for now let's eat up. Be our guest, be our guest, be our guest. Please be our guest.
What a song. And you know what? There's that line in the song, "Till you shout enough, I'm done." I don't think anyone has ever shouted that line with this song. It's never enough of that song.
Definitely not. This is the best song in the movie.
Yeah, that's a contentious point, Alan, but it's a great song. And I think it illustrates Eleanor's point really well. I mean, literally, these objects of domesticity, which in Snow White, you know, for instance, mm-hmm. really do represent this kind of truncation, this kind of hollow suburban mm-hmm. life, are kind of imbued with this kind of whimsical, magical kind of capacity.
Camp.
It's so camp.
It is
and
super
they
camp.
Literally burst out of the closet in song in this kind of fabulous cabaret.
Yeah. Well, I didn't quite get that connection when I was watching it with the plates bursting out of the cupboard, as in coming out of the closet. I did not get that. I'll have to, I'll have to come back and look at that again.
But it's pretty out.
But you know what? My favorite line in that whole song is, "If you're stressed, it's fine dining, we suggest."
I know. And you know what resonates with me?
Yeah, bingo. I'm thinking, God, if I'm stressed, I want to go fine dining. Yeah, that's great. Love it.
And look, they put a kind of spin on that track. So that, of course, is from the 1991 Beauty and the Beast classic.
Mm-hmm.
But they put a kind of spin on it in the new version, don't they? It's kind of a bit longer, drawn out.
Yeah.
But it's visually spectacular.
It is definitely a feast for the eyes.
I think, at least 80 million of the film's 160 million went on the CGI for that sequence.
And you know what? They had an actor who could sing. Ewan McGregor.
Well, they had a lot of actors who could sing, actually. Mm-hmm. Dan Stevens, who plays the Beast, has a voice, and we'll hear that a bit later on.
I was surprised.
Gaston is fantastic. Luke Evans, who plays Gaston, can really belt out. And the kind of supporting cast as well, the kind of the chorus, as it were, are pretty excellent, too.
Yeah, pretty good. And you can tell Nicole Kidman was not a member of this cast. Emma Watson can sing.
To give our listeners a kind of taste of Ewan McGregor reprising that classic song, this is Ewan McGregor with Be Our Guest.
One by one, till you shout, enough I'm done, then we'll sing you a
find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
As old as time, true as it can be, barely even friends, then somebody bends unexpectedly. Just a little change, small to say the least, both a little scared, neither one prepared. Beauty and the Beast. Ever just the same, ever a surprise, ever as before, ever just as sure as the sun will rise. As old as time, tune as old as song, bitter, sweet, and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong. Certain as the sun, rising in the east, tale as old as time. Song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Off to the cupboard with you now, Chip. It's past your bedtime. Good night, love.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where tonight we are celebrating the theatrical release of Beauty and the Beast. And that classic track is from the 1991 Disney classic, sung by Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
And, you know, what a song.
What an amazing song. Daniel, I'm going to have to take it back. You know how I said that Be Our Guest was my favourite song?
Yes.
I've suddenly remembered this is one of my favourite songs.
Well, you tear up in that song, don't you?
I tear up in this song. I'm just a hopeless romantic and I'm very sentimental. What a beautiful song. And Angela Lansbury nails it.
Oh, doesn't she?
And I'm sorry, I have to say, I love Emma Thompson. I think she's a fantastic talent, but she does not do that song the justice that Angela Lansbury did.
Oh, look, there's no doubt that 1991 recording is a classic. Mm-hmm. But to tell us more about this tale as old as time, we are joined now on the phone by Rebecca Ann de Rosario, who is a lecturer in fairy tales and children's literature. Thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now tell us about this tale as old as time, because Beauty and the Beast, I mean, it actually is a tale as old as time, isn't it?
It truly is. I mean, you can trace its origins back to mythology like Cupid and Psyche, that story in particular.
Yeah.
Echoes even today in the modern versions. But it's as Beauty and the Beast itself, it's been known since the 18th century. Villeneuve's story of Beauty and the Beast was the first with that title.
And I think there's a bit of a nod to that in this current film, because the village is also known as Villeneuve in this village. I wonder if that was a deliberate reference.
Of course.
Or it was just random. I hope so too.
It would be pretty random.
We're running with that.
But the really,
I think it should be.
The really interesting thing about this kind of literary tale, as it was in the 18th century, was that it was, you know, a cautionary tale teaching young girls about, I mean, so it has been said that it was a cautionary tale teaching young girls about the virtues of marriage.
Well, also the horrors of marriage, because yes. these were young women who would often be married off to people they perhaps would rather not be married off to.
Yes.
So tales like this were there to offer them a little bit of courage and support as well.
But it's almost
what sort of horrors are we talking about here? What horrors would Beauty and the Beast describe?
Oh, basically being married to someone who may not be attractive either physically or in personality.
Gee, okay.
A lot of women didn't have a lot of choice in who they actually married. So the story itself has its roots also in the 17th century. There were fairy tales about beastly bridegrooms earlier than Villeneuve's version. And a lot of those were warning women about, yes, you may be married to someone who's beastly, but you can make the best of this.
Well, it's a bit like the Princess and the Frog as well, isn't it? There's this kind of animal that, you know, if you're just docile enough, you know, you will find the prince in the animal.
Although I have to tell you that one of the early versions of the Frog Prince, it isn't actually a kiss that turns him into a prince. She actually slams him against a wall. She gets fed up with him and goes, no, and she smacks him against the wall, and then he turns into a handsome prince. So
what does that mean?
A lot of these tales, well, they were quite subversive because they would also teach women that they had to stand up for themselves and to be confident in themselves when they were faced with these kinds of beastly husbands.
So you've actually written quite a bit, Rebecca, about Beauty and the Beast. You know, in your opinion, the 1991 Beauty and the Beast and then this reimagining, are we seeing kind of strong, independent women? Is that what this story is about? Or do you think it kind of is a bit truer to its kind of didactic roots than we'd like to admit?
Well, I think it's a complicated question. I think there's certainly an attempt to make Belle be much stronger, much more independent, much more feminist, if you like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's still slightly on the conservative side because it's still bound within that historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be completely out there in terms of her being a modern woman, unless you actually set it in the modern era.
I mean,
so I think it's still got some baggage.
It definitely does, because I think there are times there where Belle, rather than display her superior knowledge or understanding of a technical world of clockmaking or usurping her father's expertise, she deliberately takes a back seat and allows him to take control and to show that he is the expert. And I thought that was... That's where I'm seeing that kind of watering down, that dilution of what she could have been.
The really interesting thing is, you know, she is the technological whiz in this film, not yes. her father.
Yeah.
And the one thing that we see her create is this kind of old school washing machine. So here she is, this kind of beacon of novel thought, making domestic tools.
I think that was one of the things that didn't quite sit right. Also, that washing machine monopolized the fountain. No one else could get their washing done.
I actually saw that as the drinking water as well. I'm thinking, what is she doing putting a washing machine in the drinking water? No wonder the villagers were upset.
I know. And she almost stomped on their clean clothes.
Yeah.
So
there's some problems.
So then, I mean, there have been other readings of this text. You know, that's clearly feminist readings are profuse with this story, but there are also a number of queer readings. Do you think that there is something about Beauty and the Beast that kind of lends itself to queer interpretation?
Oh, I think definitely there is. And I think actually, just putting myself out there, I think with a lot of Disney princesses in particular, with the I Wish song, they're always talking about how they don't fit into society properly and they wish for something more. They just want to be their natural selves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does have some sympathy with a lot of experience from the LGBT community. So mm-hmm. I think that in particular comes through. And even the villains themselves, they often don't fit into society. So there's often a bit of a queer reading there as well.
In this sense, are we talking about the Beast or are we talking about Gaston?
Oh, Gaston, definitely.
Well, the wonder, you know, we're going to talk about this in a little bit more depth a little bit later, but the wonderful thing I find about Gaston is he's this kind of beacon of masculinity, but it's such a kind of farcical masculinity. It really kind of inverts and plays with our ideas of the masculine ideal.
It certainly does. I mean, I remember talking about him years ago as being hyper-masculine. It's all about the muscles, it's all about appearances, mm-hmm. it's all about going out and shooting things.
That's right.
So, yeah, it definitely veers that way. He's definitely not interested in Belle as a woman.
No, he's only interested in Belle as a trophy. As yet another trophy, another animal that he can put on his wall.
She's just lucky that didn't happen.
But there is, Belle was too smart.
There is a wonderful way that this narrative, and you know, even for everything that's said about Disney, the way that Disney's telling of this story kind of moves beyond the heteronormative. It kind of challenges police desire and transcends our ideas about love.
Yes. Definitely. I mean, you do have a central love story between a beast and a girl.
Yes.
So that's got so much potential.
While we don't support bestiality on Outtakes,
certainly not.
it is curious that this one moment in the film between LeFou and another man, and it is like a blink and you miss it kind of moment, mm-hmm. is attracting so much derision and controversy, whereas the broader narrative, which is essentially a story of bestiality, has gone uncensured.
I have noticed a few tweets going around, though, about that people have got problems with this, but she's with a beast. There's bigger problems.
Rebecca.
There was also a moment there when the wardrobe was dressing some of the villagers with torches, and one of them ended up in female dress and seemed to enjoy it.
Yes.
There's a few moments there that reach out.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things I love about this story. You know, it's about transformation. When I say transformation, I mean the kind of Ovidian metamorphosis style transformation. This is about clarification. Yeah. You know, so if we're talking about drag in a similar you know, way, this story is about people being revealed for who they truly are, whether it's beauties as beasts or beasts as beauties, or village people as kind of drag queens, you know, whatever, however it is they're being transformed. This story is about revealing people's inner essences, which is, I think, something LGBTIQ audiences can identify with.
I think so too. I think that's where the narrative actually gives you that space and that play through transformation. And that's something fairy tale has done for a very, very long time too.
Can I ask, though, I think everybody transforms in this film apart from Belle.
Which is interesting.
Does she have a transformation? Mm. Am I missing something?
It's not a marked transformation in this one. I think there may have even been a little bit more of one in the original animated film, because you did see her sort of change and realize that she had to grow as well as a person.
Okay.
This one was a little bit different, I think.
We're quickly running out of time, Rebecca, but I know you've gone and seen the new film, and I would love to hear, as someone who's written so much about Beauty and the Beast, what's your take on this new version?
Oh, I think there were some wonderful things. I mean, Gaston was beautifully transitioned to the film. I think they did that exceptionally well.
Yeah.
Belle, I had a few issues with. Vocally, I have to admit, I've got a musical theatre background, so I was waiting for the belter there, and the voice was pleasant, but it wasn't quite there.
Oh, she's no Paige O'Hara, that's for sure.
She's definitely not
Paige O'Hara. She isn't, and I think that was slightly disappointing. Mm-hmm. It's not her fault, but she doesn't have Paige O'Hara's voice.
No.
And some of the costume choices there too were a bit anachronistic.
Oh, well, look, I thought you were going with like Academy Award bells for costumes, because I'm sure we'll see it nominated for best costuming. Alan's shaking his head. You don't think so?
No, that ball dress was appalling.
Yeah, oh, I disagree.
That dress did not work.
Horrible. No. The only thing I liked about that ball dress was when Madame de Garderobe was bringing the gold leaf down from the chandeliers onto the dress. I thought that was magical.
A true Disney moment.
And then when we saw the final dress, I thought, oh, my God, she's wearing a daffodil. What is that?
I think that pretty much is it. And the Beast was so beautifully dressed too, it just was a bit disappointing.
You see, I was like, Oscar bells. Look, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Rebecca. Thank you again for making the time to join us on Outtakes.
No, my pleasure. I enjoyed talking about it.
Thanks, Rebecca. You are listening to Outtakes, where we are queering Disney's live-action reimagining of Beauty and the Beast.
Put our service to the test.
Ooh.
Tie your napkin round your neck, Sherry, and we provide the rest.
There must be some way to break the curse.
Well, there is one.
The monster has her under his spell.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, the home of queer cinema. And we are celebrating the theatrical release of Disney's Beauty and the Beast. And what an incredible film. What a lavish film. Just earlier, that was Rebecca and Rosario speaking to us about the kind of literary origins of the tale and some of the queer and feminist themes in it's a franchise, I suppose. Yeah. And there really is something to be said for the way that this film deals with masculinity and femininity.
And I think that comes out quite clearly in terms of masculinity with Gaston. I think we just talked about how hyper-masculine he is. And I think the film goes to great extents to extol his masculine virtue and his hyper-masculinity. I think in the original, one thing that I was a little bit disappointed in the second film was that I was actually, in the animated version there, you actually see a scene there where Gaston bursts open his shirt and you see his hairy chest. And I was just waiting for that to happen in this film.
Of course you were.
And I was bitterly disappointed, you know. I mean, I was thinking, you know, Gaston would have to be a muscle bear and would definitely appeal in some senses to our bear audience. Possibly.
Well, that's a funny thing, because there are two muscle bears in this film, Gaston and, of course, Beast. And
Beast, of course.
Well, but you see, Beast, of course, who says, "I am not a beast," yeah, kind of towards the end. And I think I don't recall that being in the original.
No, it wasn't.
And I know pretty much every line from the original. But and I love that line, because what that does is draw our attention to the title, right? So this is called Beauty and the Beast, yeah, right? And for me, you know, this is where Belle actually gets left out, because for me, the title is telling us, and I think you might disagree, Alan, but hear me out.
Okay.
For me, the title is telling us this is a story about Gaston and about Beast, because Gaston is the beauty who is really a beast, and Beast is the beast who is really a beauty. And the story is about the kind of transformation from beauty to beast and from beast to beauty. Mm-hmm. And so I think the title is kind of hinting to us that this is a story about these two characters, that it is these two characters who are the dynamic, interesting characters, the characters who develop and change. And as I think you rightly pointed out earlier, Belle is a little bit stagnant in the story.
And you know what? That's absolutely true. I think, as we said before, nearly every other character transforms, but Belle doesn't in particular. When we're talking here about a Beauty and the Beast, I can totally see how you see Gaston as the Beast slash Beauty, and also the Beast as the Beast slash Beauty. And you know, I didn't actually see it that way. You've opened my eyes.
And Belle is this vehicle that kind of facilitates the transformations, but doesn't actually transform herself. So that's what's so fascinating about this text. And actually, I think that's a really good kind of window into the homosocial kind of possibilities that this text gives rise to. We've spoken a little bit about homosociality before. It's this kind of theory about the kind of female in a story being a conduit for male desire.
Like a catalyst. In this case, Belle is a true catalyst.
Well, exactly.
She remains unchanged.
And what she does is she mediates the sexual tension between Beast and between Gaston. So I'm positing a reading of this story
story as the ultimate display in mask for mask kind of attraction, and Belle is this kind of conduit for that attraction.
You know, Daniel, I think you're drawing a long bow there, because there's very little interaction between Gaston and the Beast. But, you know, I really like the theory up until that stage, right up until the end. Really liking it. I'm buying into it, but I just don't see. There is just no relationship between the Beast.
Well,
and
this
Gaston.
Is what Eleanor Byrne had to say about homosocial possibilities in Beauty and the Beast, and indeed in Disney's broader work.
Kosofsky Sedgwick is interesting, I think. She helps with readings of what seem to be heteronormative. And if Disney's not heteronormative or perceived to be until very recently, then I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So I think she really helps because she's interested in talking about the ways in which homosexuality gets excluded through this primacy of the homosocial. The idea of male friendship and rivalry, which has to be directed through, allegedly through, their competition for a female heroine of some kind.
Mm.
So that there's a way in which we can read same-sex friendship as profoundly interested in, even if they are attempting to marginalize the homosexual. So the homosocial, the kinds of bodies of friendship that we see in so many texts, yes, such as Hercules and Hades, produce a really interesting way of reading where we can see the men both in relation to one another and redirecting and sometimes excluding the female, who is a site of desire only. She doesn't actually desire anybody, but she's a sort of conduit for desire. I think more broadly that is interesting because it suggests a kind of intertwining of heterosexual and homosexual or queer dynamics, so that once we talk about sexuality at all and the language of desire in film, we're not necessarily ever really just talking about the heteronormative.
Mm.
We're always actually caught up in the ways in which queer desires might be operating or can be found, which I think opens up so many Disney texts to ways of thinking that perhaps is suggestive of their enormous popularity for gay viewers. It's not the case that the Disney conservative reputation or the family-centric reputation of Disney has in any way stopped Disney having an enormous role in the queer culture.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, the Disney Gay Days would be, Disneyland Gay Days would be a fantastic example of the fact that there is clearly a way of understanding and reading Disney that is profoundly suited to different forms of queer identity.
That was our chat with academic Eleanor Byrne, whose book Deconstructing Disney really does a great job at making the case for why Beauty and the Beast is, you know, a gay text, a queer mm-hmm. classic. And I do love the way that this film, I think the new Beauty and the Beast film, really plays with masculinity and femininity
mm-hmm.
In some really interesting ways. You know, Belle is kind of truncated in this tower the same way as the rose is truncated in this vase.
Mm-hmm.
And, she talks about the need for being free, and it's quite clear she's talking about the need for women to be free.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're given a really kind of farcical masculinity in Gaston, and then this really kind of nuanced, soft masculinity in the Beast.
And also with Le Fou, would you
well, that's more sycophancy, I think. But the wonderful thing about, and you can see how they've kind of fleshed out this new form of masculinity mm-hmm. in The Beast. And that's kind of put, mm-hmm. Put on screen with this new song that they've written, Evermore, that Dan Stevens does a wonderful job of singing.
Oh, he does. It's brilliant.
I was the one who had it all. I was the master of my fate. I never needed anybody in my life. I learned the truth too late. I'll never shake away the pain. I close my eyes, but she's still there. Let her steal into my melancholy heart. It's more than I can bear. Now I know she'll waiting by an open door. I'll fool myself, she'll walk right in and be with me forevermore. I rage against the trials of love. I curse the fading of the light. Though she's already flown so far beyond my reach, she's never out of sight. Now I know she'll never leave me, even as she fades from view. She will still inspire me, be a part of everything I do. I'll fool myself, she'll walk right in. And as the long, long nights begin, I'll think of all that might have been waiting here for.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. That was Dan Stevens singing Evermore from Disney's new live action reimagining of Beauty and the Beast. And what a great track.
What a great addition to Beauty and the Beast, to the lexicon of the Beauty and the Beast musical.
He's got a voice.
Oh my God. You know, I was stunned. I was very surprised and very happy.
Look, Alan, it's been a true pleasure queering Beauty and the Beast with you tonight. I think we've really made a case for why this film is a gay classic.
Agreed, Daniel. And you know what? I'm very happy that this came out on my birthday this year. It was a birthday present for me.
And what a present.
It was.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.